Hi, I'm Sarah, and I'm going to get a tattoo from Electric Tattoo in Carpentersville, and you're listening to Outside the Loop, Chicago's almost above ground audio magazine.
Thank you very much. Welcome to Outside the Loop. Yes, this is Chicago's almost above ground audio magazine. I am Mike Steven. It is great to be here with you today for show number 938. What we do here on this program is take a look at local issues and topics that don't always get mainstream media attention. Bob Ferguson is our engineer on duty today in the WGN radio studio. So happy to have Bob along and you, the listener, as well. Coming up on the show today, we get an update on education issues in Chicago, and there is a lot happening there. Also, we dive into the history of black entrepreneurship in the city, and that is a rich history. Speaking of history, so many of us have a history of growing up around here and watching our favorite sports teams on TV. And yes, there are periods when certain teams were blacked out, but I still remember watching the 1985 Bears season, and I was 5 at the time. I remember going to my grandparents' house and watching Cubs games with my grandpa on WGN Channel 9. Those memories are seared into my mind. Today, we are living in a time when more and more sports teams are creating their own TV networks that air their games. We saw this happen with the Cubs and the Marquee Network. And now, the Sox, Bulls, and Hawks are doing the same thing. It's called the Chicago Sports Network and will be bundled into subscriptions for DirecTV. That runs you about $75 a month for 125 channels, including the Chicago Sports Network. If you don't have DirecTV, well, you can go ahead and get old school and buy an antenna. According to Nielsen, about 15% of the almost 3.5 million homes in the Chicago market watch TV using an antenna. I know these teams are big businesses, but they are also part of the cultural fabric of Chicago. Creating barriers to watching these games, like a special sports network that you have to pay for, lessens the rabid loyalty of the fan base, because not everyone can or is willing to pay. In my own life, if I couldn't watch those Cubs and Bears games as a kid, I don't think I would have the allegiance to those teams that I do now. And maybe I would be saving myself some disappointment, but we'll never know. In my opinion, the more access we have to watch our local sports teams, the more we will want to actually go to a game. I mean, my kids are clamoring for me to take them to a Bears game and to spend about $700 for tickets, food, and a souvenir that day. And if you think that number is an exaggeration, according to bookies.com, the team's game day at Soldier Field, rated as the 12th most expensive in the NFL, fans pay an average of about $713 per game. And really, who wanted to pay money to watch the White Sox play on TV this season? Just saying. Bottom line, the more access we have, the more loyalty we have. Let's talk about some local history, specifically the history of black entrepreneurship in Chicago. This is the title of a new article authored by Dr. Robert Weems Jr. He is the Willard W. Garvey Distinguished Professor of Business History at Wichita State University, and he is here with us today on Outside the Loop to talk about this topic. Dr. Weems, welcome to the show.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Nice to have you here. So, as you write, there really is a rich history of black entrepreneurship in Chicago. And as you write about, you go all the way back to DuSable, Chicago's first entrepreneur who was black. And as you write, he sets an example for future generations. Can you tell us about what that example is?
Well, the fact that DuSable, and again, is interesting because his life remains, you know, kind of shrouded in mystery to a certain extent, but his, you know, entrepreneurial activities are well documented. You know, the trading posts that he established in what later became Chicago was considered to be, you know, the most substantive in the middle western part of the country, and it was could be easily compared to, you know, Detroit and St. Louis. So from a business and entrepreneurial standpoint, what he was able to do was no small feat.
And again, that sort of sets the tone for what's going to follow generations down the road here, with some difficulty, though, because I think this is interesting. You write about some notable success stories when it comes to Black entrepreneurship in Chicago. So we're looking at these stories of success. And when that success is happening throughout history, as we fast forward a little bit and get into the 19th century, there's also a good amount of discrimination happening here, and in the form of things like the Black codes. So we might hear that, hey, on one hand there's success, but on the other hand there's discrimination. So I want to ask you, that could be confusing. How is this possible? How is that success happening despite the fact that there is rampant discrimination, racial discrimination here in Chicago?
Well, that's a great question, because again, I think when we come to, you know, business and entrepreneurship, and especially when we look at, you know, African Americans engage in business, if we see individuals providing unique services and products to a community, oftentimes that discrimination, in fact, becomes muted. For instance, John Jones is arguably, you know, the most significant African American entrepreneur in 19th century Chicago. Mm-hmm. He was a tailor, and one of his claims to fame was that he was the first Black entrepreneur to actually establish a shop in downtown Chicago. And by all accounts, you know, he had a very, you know, prosperous enterprise. You know, some of the numbers in 1860, you know, his worth was estimated to be about $10,000. In 1870, before the Great Fire, you know, his worth was estimated to be $100,000.
Wow.
So again, I think history is pretty clear that notwithstanding discrimination, that if someone is able to provide a needed service, that, you know, in the end, economics does trump prejudice in many respects. And I just want to say one more thing about John Jones, to put him in clear perspective. As the most successful Black entrepreneur of the time, he actually used his influence to, in fact, help eradicate some of the larger discrimination that all African Americans were dealing with. So, you know, we have to really give him his props.
That's a really interesting point, that we were willing to look the other way if, hey, you're providing a service for all of us. Sure, well, you know, you're kind of, we'll do business with you, you're in. But otherwise, those traditions and some of those laws, they stood the test of time. And really, when you are talking about this time kind of getting into the early 20th century, you talk about policy kings and their influence. So this term policy kings, can you explain what this is? I think this is really interesting.
Going to the policy kings of the 20th century, a policy which represented a sort of precursor to today's government-sponsored lotteries, were games of chance that, in fact, had been, you know, prevalent in Chicago's African-American community and other African-American communities across the country. And an interesting sidebar was that, you know, during the Great Depression, you had a lot of established Black enterprises in Chicago, such as banks, that were casualties of the Great Depression. But the game of policy was, in fact, able to continue and, in fact, thrive to a certain extent. And it was very interesting because technically policy was illegal, but these individuals were able to skirt the law, if you will, by, you know, paying off, you know, unscrupulous politicians who urge the police to, you know, look the other way in terms of what these policy kings were doing. And when we look at the 1930s, in fact, I mentioned in the article that Time magazine featured an article on what was then called Negro business in Chicago. And it noted that the most, you know, prominent you know, policy kings in Chicago during this period, the Jones brothers, were literally, you know, among the most prosperous black business people in the country. And we see these individuals using what we might call today, you know, laundered funds
right.
to get into, quote unquote, legitimate enterprises. And in fact, the Jones brothers were noteworthy, among other things, for establishing the first department store in the country that was owned by African Americans.
That's really interesting. And as you talk about, kind of like an underground economy is happening here with these policy kings. They're getting people jobs. They're providing employment opportunities for those African Americans who are working class. And they are, I mean, reinvesting basically in the community. So even though they're doing stuff that maybe might be illegal, you know, on one hand, the other hand, here they are giving back to the community.
Yeah, and in fact, in many circles, you know, the policy kings in the African-American community were viewed as heroes. Again, besides providing jobs, they also, for instance, provided, you know, startup capital to some prospective, you know, African-American, you know, quote-unquote legitimate African-American entrepreneurs that had difficulty, you know, getting loans from banks. So it was kind of a mixed bag. You know, you did have some ministers in the African-American community who, you know, criticized what the policy kings were doing. But you had a significant percentage of African-Americans that viewed these individuals as positive because, among other things, they were supplying jobs. And when we look at, quote unquote, the underground economy of the 1930s, say compared to more recent manifestations, you know, buying a lottery ticket or buying, you know, playing a numbers game, that what was also called, was a lot more benign than, say, you know, drug activity that came to characterize, you know, the underground economy
right.
later in the 20th century.
Yeah. And into the 20th century, as you write here in your piece, you talk about John H. Johnson. And this is a really important figure in black entrepreneurship in Chicago because he is really going to make a name for himself publishing this periodical, Negro Digest, which is basically a black version of Reader's Digest. And he, in 1945, began publishing Ebony Magazine, which is the black version of Life Magazine. And you say by the 1960s, he is, you could say, the most important black business person in the country. It's a remarkable story.
Yes, it is, you know, because literally John H. Johnson, you know, part his business plan or his idea in terms of Ebony was, first of all, he wanted to have a magazine that focused on, you know, African-American success stories, because a lot of the media at the time, you know, really focused on negative aspects of African-American life. And John H. Johnson, in fact, wanted to portray and, in fact, spotlight, you know, positive dynamics of the African-American experience. But also from a business standpoint, at this point in time, we saw the African-American population increasingly being viewed as an important consumer market. And in fact, John H. Johnson viewed Ebony Magazine as, and in fact, this is what he in fact sold to future corporate advertisers in Ebony Magazine, that this would be the ideal venue to advertise your products in to reach the increasingly important African-American consumer market.
So that was John H. Johnson, and there is another individual with the last name Johnson who is incredibly influential here. A little later on in the 1960s and 1970s, George Johnson, he had a company called the Johnson Products Company based in Chicago, and they had a self-care product. And they also get very famous because they are going to be the initial corporate sponsor of an incredibly popular television show. What's the story with George Johnson?
George Johnson, in fact, and his African-American, you know, personal care and hair care products company took advantage of the Afro hair phenomenon of the 1960s. Because, in fact, Johnson Products produced something called Afro Sheen, which was a major hit in terms of the African-American consumer market. And one of the reverberations of the success of Afro-Sheen was that, you know, Johnson Products, in fact, became the first black-owned company to be traded on a major stock exchange in the early 1970s. And, in fact, it was Johnson Products that, in fact, was the first corporate sponsor of the enormously successful syndicated television program, Soul Train.
That's really incredible. And as you write about here, you take us into the 80s and 90s. And of course, when we talk about black entrepreneurship, we have to talk about Oprah. We're still talking about Oprah today. She really just revolutionized. I mean, you think about the west side of Chicago and how that area has changed because in part of her moving in there with Harpo Productions in that community and really just getting the massive attention. And even to this day, she remains this titan in media. And I remember, I mean, just growing up in that era, anything that Oprah would talk about or endorse would immediately just become so popular, would sell out, people would clamor for it. She really is a pillar in this story, isn't she?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oprah represents sort of a quintessential entrepreneur that, again, was able to, you know, parlay her initial investment, in fact, ownership of the Oprah Winfrey Show, and was later to expand that into marketing, television programs, and movies. Later, there was the magazine, because it was almost like literally everything she touched, you know, turned to gold in terms of her, you know, entrepreneurial pursuits.
Yeah. So I want to ask you today, where are we when it comes to black entrepreneurship in Chicago? You've laid out the history here. And when we talk about the history, we look to that history to inform us a little bit of where we've been, but also who we are today. In terms of where things are with black entrepreneurship, are we seeing that continuation of that rich legacy in Chicago today?
Well, when we look at more recent dynamics of black entrepreneurship in Chicago, it's on one level the best of times. We look at somebody like Oprah Winfrey, and it's the worst of times. In the article, I mentioned African-American insurance companies. There were several very important black insurance companies in Chicago in the early to mid and even into the late 20th century. Today, there are no black-owned legal reserve insurance companies in the city. And these companies, in their heyday, provided a variety of important services to local African-Americans. But that being said, you know, because of this rich legacy of entrepreneurship, there continue to be a variety of, you know, entrepreneurial things going on in Chicago. Because, again, you can't have sort of, you know, that very important entrepreneurial history, black entrepreneurial history in Chicago, and just see how that comes to a screeching halt. Even though, again, certain industries have disappeared as compared to a century ago.
I think this is really fascinating history, and it's important history. We should be thinking about it, especially in the context of where we are today. This history matters. And this article is really a great read, The History of Black Entrepreneurship in Chicago by Dr. Robert Weems Jr., who is the Willard W. Garvey Distinguished Professor of Business History at Wichita State University. Dr. Weems, thank you so much for talking to us about this today.
My pleasure. Take care now.
There is a lot happening locally when it comes to education. Chalkbeat Chicago is a local, nonprofit, independent newsroom that helps keep tabs on all things local education. And Rima Amin is a reporter at that organization. We can check out chalkbeat.org. And Rima is here with us once again on Outside the Loop. Rima, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much for having me again.
Nice to have you here to get this education update, and lots to get to. And it's all, I think, pretty impactful stuff. So towards the end of September, the Chicago Public Schools Board of Education approved this plan that lays out CPS priorities for the next 5 years. There's a lot in here, but from an overview perspective, what are some things that this plan is proposing?
Yeah, so what they approved towards the end of September was called the district's five-year strategic plan. Folks may not remember the name, but it did cause a big stir in December because back then, this board said that, you know, when we develop this upcoming strategic plan, we want to rethink school choice in that plan. And so, you know, for your listeners, school choice is your selective enrollment school, magnet schools, charter schools, any schools that are not your neighborhood options that you kind of apply for and literally choose to go to, you know, and instead of your neighborhood option. And so this board citing, you know, demographics that weren't aligning at these schools with the rest of the city, as well as like really competitive enrollment and admissions policies, they said they wanted to rethink school choice in this plan. And of course, that caused a lot of stir. It also caused a lot of misinformation, which hopefully we successfully combated to some extent.
Sure.
But what ended up happening was when the board actually did come out with this plan last month and approve it, it actually didn't really do anything to suggest changes to school choice. You know, we asked the board why we didn't see anything in there, you know, changes to admissions policies or something like that. And, you know, they said, look, we're still committed to that idea, but we did a lot of, you know, we collected a lot of feedback from the community and we heard the community. There's a lot of people that really value choice. And so, you know, instead, what the plan does and what they said they felt was more important was to, you know, really vocalize and make a commitment towards investing more resources into neighborhood schools. So again, the school that is in your attendance area, that's down the street that you're zoned to attend. And in the plan, there's actually an explicit goal. So I should back up and say the plan has a lot more to do than school choice.
Right.
It sets out lots of goals for reducing chronic absenteeism, for, you know, raising test scores, for improving academics, and for improving, you know, the public's perception of culture at every school. But it also has a goal that explicitly calls for this, you know, calls to see more district, as more CPS students attending their neighborhood schools over the next 5 years. You know, right now, I think about 3/4 of high school students, if I have that figure right, choose to go to a school outside of their neighborhood. And then the same is true for, I believe, 44% of elementary school kids.
Wow. So, I mean, that school choice, and we've talked about it before, it's really a big thing when you have those statistics that you just said. When you have most of the students who are going to schools outside of their schools where they're zoned for, I mean, that's tremendous. So I know that there were a lot of magnet schools, like you said, that were freaking out, charter schools that were really concerned. This plan doesn't really address school choice, but what you're saying is that the emphasis instead is going to be more on neighborhood schools, how to improve those and how to increase enrollment there. Is that what we're saying with this?
Yes, essentially, yeah. And that's what the district wants to see. They want to see more kids go, you know, choosing their neighborhood option over exercising that school choice option. And I should say, you know, the language is interesting. Like your neighborhood school, you can think of that as, you know, maybe where you're zoned to go to school. But this plan actually doesn't specify that. It says any school in your, it's essentially saying schools in your community. So that, I mean, that could still involve a level of choice, but, you know, I think the broader goal, it seems, is to embrace policies in a way that families will see more value in the school that's down the street or closer to their home.
And the board passed a resolution, actually, saying it won't close schools until 2027. So that was a concern, too, because some of these, again, these magnet schools, these charter schools were concerned that the resources would be shifted away from them and maybe they would have to close. But the board is saying we're not even looking at that until 2027.
That's right. And you know, that actually, that closing moratorium was unrelated to those concerns that we've heard from, you know, choice school advocates over the past, you know, 9 months. That closing moratorium, actually, they took action on that because, you know, over the past couple of weeks, there's been a lot of, you know, separate storyline, but a lot of pressure on CPS CEO Pedro Martinez to step down. And, you know, in that pressure campaign, the Chicago Teachers Union said that it got its hands on a district analysis that had a list of schools where, you know, the district said if we wanted to do co-locations, aka really closing schools, we could look at, you know, this list of 140 schools. And so, you know, they put this out in public. The district said, look, that analysis we put together to create our strategic plan. But we did that many months ago, and you know, it was purely an analysis, and it actually confirmed for us and the Board of Education that we don't want to close any schools.
You mentioned CPS CEO Pedro Martinez. There's been some drama there, and of course, in Chicago, we have to follow the politics and the money and all of this. And I think all of that is really part of this conversation. The CEO, Pedro Martinez, was basically asked by Mayor Johnson to resign. Can you briefly explain what the tension is here? What is happening? How is this playing out?
Yeah, briefly is an interesting word here, but I will do my best. So, all of this tension between the mayor and the NCPS and, you know, Pedro Martinez really spilled out into public over the summer when the district was getting ready to adopt a budget that had cuts in it. You know, they were looking at a $500 million deficit fueled by the loss of this, like, billions of COVID, you know, federal recovery money that districts across the nation had received. Lots of districts had done lots of different things with it, including CPS, but it was expiring and there was suddenly this big budget deficit. And so CPS makes, you know, a bunch of cuts to help balance the budget. But as is usual, the district did not include the cost of a new teacher's contract in its budget. It also did not include a pension payment for non-teaching staff that has been required of the city since Lori Lightfoot was mayor. And so City Hall did not like this. And also, it seemed was concerned about, you know, the cuts that came along with balancing the budget. And the loss of some, you know, teacher assistants and actually hundreds of positions like that. And so Mayor Johnson expresses his displeasure at the budget with the budget, but his appointed board decides to approve the budget anyway. So kind of a, you know, a bit of a stunning vote to kind of defy the mayor's wishes. And so then things kind of begin to sort of unravel publicly from there. You know, at one point, the mayor's office asked CPS to take out a short-term loan, which likely, you know, you take out a short-term loan to help cover costs like the teachers union contract and the pension payment. And he said, you know, this administration said this would kind of solve that problem. And the district rejected that as well and said, you know, if we do that, we're going to have lots of high interest rates to deal with, and that's going to saddle us with even bigger amount of deficit down the road. It's going to take money away from classrooms, and it's going to help downgrade our already junk bond rating status, which is what we rely on to make sure we get good interest rates to borrow in the future. And so once again, the district rebuffs the mayor, defies his wishes, and says, we're not going to do that. And so all of this is happening as the teachers union, which is a very close ally of Mayor Brandon Johnson, is negotiating its next contract. And in those discussions, you know, the district has said, look, we want to partner with you. And the union has a huge package of proposals, which range from 9% raises for teachers to providing more support for students in classrooms to helping homeless families. So, like, very wide ranging. And the district is kind of saying, we don't have all the money for that. And so the union has been pretty critical of CPS as well. And so with all of this tension, you know, a few weeks ago, the mayor called, according to our reporting and other news outlets, the mayor called Pedro Martinez into his office after the big ShotSpotter vote and asked him to resign. And Martinez declined. And in a pretty extraordinary public move, Martinez wrote an op-ed in the Tribune and said, "The mayor asked me to resign and I'm not going to." And it's not, that's not meant to insult the mayor. It's because I think the district needs stability. And I should say the reason I cited us and other news outlets is because the mayor has now publicly said that he didn't really ask Pedro Martinez to resign. And we haven't received clarity on that, but that's kind of the latest twist here.
Wow. And all this, like you say, in the backdrop of union negotiations for the next contract, that's happening here. And also, I mentioned this before, but there will be an elected school board, or at least partially elected, in January. And I know that at chalkbeat.org, you have been covering a bunch of these local school board contests. So if you're curious about this, we can go to chalkbeat.org. And I think that's really important because, you know, where else are we going to go to get information on these candidates? But has that race, I mean, it's coming in November. I mean, are things kind of heating up as you see it?
Yeah, I think so. And yeah, please, like, you know, we're encouraging people to go to our website. We also created a, we wrote profiles about every district, and then we have a voter guide that we created with WBEZ and the Sun-Times. And so you can go to either of our websites to find that. But yeah, the race is heating up. And actually, just last night, my colleagues, Mila and Becky, wrote a story about how, you know, the big school choice pack has, over the past week, has dumped $500,000 into races in an effort to outspend and out-influence the Chicago Teachers Union. And so for a while, we weren't seeing like big money in these races. And now it's really heating up. So I think that's a definite indicator of that. And yeah, I mean, who you're going to see on the ballot has been finalized. And, you know, I think candidates in various districts have been going to just like local forums, things like that, to share their views with voters. And this is kind of the home stretch. You know, we're in the last month, and I think you're going to see more things like that. And so, yeah, we'll continue to watch that.
All right. Well, we can all go to chalkbeat.org. Lots of really great reporting when it comes to local education issues on that website. And Rima Amin is a reporter at Chalkbeat Chicago. Again, that is a local nonprofit independent newsroom that is keeping tabs on all things local education. Rima, as always, I really appreciate the time. Thanks for all of your reporting and keep it going.
Oh, thank you so much.
And that just about does it. Outside the Loop show number 938 is done. Thank you so much for listening to the show this week. You rule. So does Bob Ferguson. He's our engineer in the WGN radio studio. Have a wonderful week. I will talk to you again next time right here on Outside the Loop.